For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. You are about to encounter some incredibly courageous people and some extraordinary stories of survival, courtesy of an amazing new book called I Live to Tell the World, Stories from Survivors of Holocaust, Genocide, and the Atrocities of War. It's written by Elizabeth Marin, a writer and educator now based in Portland, Oregon, whose career has taken her to the Los Angeles Times, on the Washington Post, and she has also taught at Boston University. This is her fifth book. The story actually springs out of a nonprofit project called The Immigrant Story, begun by Sankar Raman. Sankar Raman was noticing in 2017 that the national story around immigrants among us had become quite bitter and even toxic. And he was anxious for the story of immigrants to be told in a more meaningful way. So he began this nonprofit, The Immigrant Story, and they began gathering stories of all kinds of different immigrants and just trying to get a handle on what their ordinary lives were like. It was only in this gathering process that it became apparent that some of these immigrants had come to America under incredibly dramatic, harrowing circumstances, in many cases barely escaping with their lives from horrific situations. As this theme began to reassert itself again and again, it became important for these particular stories to be brought forth in a special way. Hence the gathering of 13 such survival stories in all for this particular book. Again, it's titled, I Live to Tell the World, Stories from Survivors of Holocaust, Genocide, and the Atrocities of War, published by Oregon State University Press. And again, the author, Elizabeth Marin.
The first one that I remember doing for I didn't know it was going to be a book. I went off to interview Les and Eva Egner, who are the first people profiled in this book, and they're Holocaust survivors. Les was in four different camps. He was originally from the Czech Republic, but he was from Hungary ultimately. She was from Budapest. When Les was 15 years old, he was sent to Auschwitz. He was so young, so naive, that he thought that the giant smokestacks that were billowing white smoke were the bakeries at the camp, not the crematoriums. Meanwhile, Eva was a young girl, and she and her sister and mother, her father was taken away. They'd been living a comfortable middle-class existence. And they were sent, her father was killed, and they were sent to the notorious, horrible, unthinkable Jewish ghetto in Budapest, which was just crawling with people and rodents and horrible things. And their survival story, Eva's and her sister's, is accountable. You can only say it, you can only account for it by believing in miracles. So I spent hours with them. These were very, very immersive interviews, all of them. Hours and hours and hours, and then I would go back and spend more and more. And I was drawn into these stories in a way that, as an arm's-length journalist, I was not always drawn into things. You know, there's an old saying in journalism, file it and forget it. You know, you go, you do the story, and then you move on. But these stories were lingering with me in my brain, my soul, my heart. They were important stories, and they were worthy. These were stories that needed to be told. So one day Sankar says to me, we should write a book. And that's kind of the way he is. He's very sort of, he's extremely optimistic and very, and as I said, he's very persuasive. No, Sankar, it's really not quite that easy. That's not how you do it. He said, yep, that's how we're going to do it. So we did. And we didn't quite know where it was going to go at that point, but we felt that they needed to be gathered and collected and preserved. And so that's what we did. We have more than 60 of these stories now on the website, theimmigrantstory.org. And we had to be able to somehow... we had to be able to collect them somehow and have certain guidelines for collecting them. So we decided we really wanted diversity of experiences, diversity of events. We wanted diversity of age and gender. And we wanted verifiability, which was really important. We wanted to be able, and so there were some really wonderful stories that we did not include because we could not verify some of the details. And then arbitrarily, again, because we had to have certain bookends, we decided all of these survivors were going to live in Oregon. And the important point about that is that although they do all live in Oregon, this book could be written anywhere. This book could certainly be written in Wisconsin. This book, these people, these wonderful, brave, strong people live among us on a daily basis.
I wanted to ask you about this point of verifiability, because that is something that is mentioned in Sankar Raman's introduction to the book. He mentions this matter more than once. In fact, he says essentially as you did, we rejected several stories because we could not verify key details. In the end, we looked for and selected strong, honest stories whose facts we could verify. From the outset, our intention was to assure the authenticity of the voices we were presenting. I find that really interesting because I have no doubt that in many cases, when such stories are told, even when they are perhaps gathered into a book or put into print, that that kind of specific concern is not paramount, and maybe for laudable reasons. I mean, one might just be so taken by the tragedy or the inspiration of a given story that the whole matter of verifying whether or not it really occurred the way it's being told doesn't even dawn on them. But obviously, this was very important for him, for you, for others involved in the immigrant story. Tell us more about this focus on authenticity and being able to verify these stories. Why has that been so important in all of this?
Well, first of all, I'm a journalist, and there's always been sort of a double source rule in my life, which is basically any fact has to be confirmed at least twice, and sometimes way more than that. And you know, confirming it does not mean going to Wikipedia. In fact, as a journalism professor, I basically told my students that if they used anything from Wikipedia, including of and the, I would fail them. But because I think those facts are not necessarily confirmable. But so that was part of it. Is I felt that was preserving the integrity of the stories. Also, there's memory plays strange tricks on people. I'm sure you remember that game Telephone we all played as a kid, where it goes around you to say a word to somebody and it goes around and it comes back and it's unrecognizable. Well, that's sort of like memory sometimes. And I think particularly memories that involve trauma, sometimes they're very crystal clear and sometimes they're not. And sometimes they're kind of mushy and things go together that didn't really go together and things. So we wanted to make sure that these were genuine. We had a couple of stories that, again, as I said, we simply couldn't confirm some of the details or the things didn't gel. People would say things that there were inconsistencies in their stories. There's always inconsistencies typically inconsistencies in stories, but these would be inconsistencies that provided room for doubt or room for question. These events are real historical events, all of them. And we didn't want to interfere with the reality of the events by having someone say, well, you know, that person was just really upset that day or something. We wanted actual, verifiable, chronological details and facts. Hmm. It took a lot of work, a lot of work. And I will tell you also, some of it was really, it was hair pulling on my part, because some of these events that some of it are going on right now, some of the events in this book, and there's not a lot of documentation, or if there is, there's contradictory documentation. Or some of it is really based on some of the evils of Eurocolonization from 75 or 100 years ago. So it's hard in some ways to actually go back and confirm some of this stuff. I mean, I spent weeks and weeks and weeks culling through information and talking to experts on various things, because I wanted to make sure that these facts were right.
Mm. And I appreciate us taking a moment to talk about this, because, again, I think one might have a perfectly worthwhile book even apart from that, but it wouldn't be the same kind of thing. I mean, the fact that your book has that, in a sense, sturdy spine of truth makes it an even more important book than it would otherwise be. I want to ask you about a couple of things that you mention in chapter one, and these are your words in a chapter called So Much to Tell the World. One of the things you say is, our choice of the narrative format for this book was quite intentional. Tell us what those intentions are, the intentions behind that particular choice.
Right. Well, I actually had to add that chapter to sort of placate the university press rules and regulations, and I'm glad I did, because it solidifies some of it. I'm a big believer in the power of storytelling. I think they are stories that normalize and humanize great global events. Sometimes, and again, I'm speaking as a journalist who spent a lot of time with a notebook covering some of these events. So, but these are real life lived experiences. These are from people who went through these experiences, not from people who stood at arm's length with a notebook. And these are, or who came in 5, 10, 20 years later to analyze and assess them with brilliant scholarly minds. These are lived experiences. And to me, that's the first person, that's the most vibrant and vital way to both understand situations and to almost live through them vicariously in a way. And I wanted these stories to come alive. I wanted them to have the power of these lived human beings who went through them. So that was also, narrative is, there's a pace to it. I think it's easier to read sometimes, and more interesting for me as both a reader and a writer, than kind of cold facts and bullet points and data driven. Well, there's data in here too, but it's data driven, cold, distant facts. These are real people's voices, people who lived through them, and who carry these experiences in their hearts and souls. When I asked one of our survivors, and I get kind of possessive about them, I call them, you know, my survivors, but and they're friends. I mean, I spend time with them now, and I respect them tremendously. But when I asked, well, it was Emmanuel Touratoranyi, who survived the Rwandan genocide, and I asked him why he wanted to tell this, why he thought he had survived the massacres that had killed almost everyone else in his very, very large extended family. And he paused. He's a thoughtful guy. And he paused and he said, I think I lived in order to tell the world. So that was an impulse that I wanted to capture in narrative, in storytelling, and in his experiences and in others in that same way. Hmm. There's one other point I wanted to make, which is that nobody was forced to tell these stories. Everybody, there was no arm twisting. In fact, it was quite the opposite. People wanted to tell the stories. Saron Koot, who was a child survivor of the Cambodian genocide, his mother spent almost 5 years working in the killing fields. His father was killed by the Khmer Rouge when Saron was just 5 years old and became the man in the family as a consequence. And Saron, again, living in a sort of an American trope, graduated with honors from Portland State University, had management jobs at FedEx and Intel, and is now kind of the ambassador of the Southeast Asian community here in Portland, owning a restaurant and organizing incredible events and things. And he said, I couldn't wait to tell my story. So the key word in that is also story. That's what they are. And a story has a framework. It has a beginning, it has a middle, and an end. And I find as a reader, it's more engaging to me sometimes than, again, the arm's length analysis of even me, the cold-eyed journalist.
Right. You also mentioned in this challenge, in this chapter, it's important to note that we remained mindful of the sensitive nature of each narrative in this book, so much so that we engaged in active collaboration with our subjects. Describe in your own words the nature of that collaboration and what that experience was like, especially for you.
Well, that's a really good question, because if you had told me 10 years ago, again, when I'm teaching students how to be good journalists, that I was going to practice something I'm now calling collaborative journalism, I might well have thrown something at you or, you know, told you you were nuts, because it violated my own sense of canons and ethics. However, in this case, we really wanted to preserve the authenticity of their voice, of the voices of these survivors. That was very, very important to us. And I felt also, again, as I said to you, memory plays funny tricks. And sometimes people were writing about, we were writing about places that are very, they're distant, they're obscure. Some of them are little tiny villages that may or may not even be on a map some places. Or maybe they're on a regional and provincial map in Myanmar or Bosnia, but they're not necessarily a map that I look at on a daily basis. So we wanted to make sure things were correct. And sequence. Sometimes, you know, you tell a story, again, going back to the telephone game, you tell a story, and this happened, then this happened, then this happened. Well, actually, no, it wasn't ABC, it was ACB. And people themselves go back, and they look at this, and they're like, well, that's kind of not what happened. They remember. So again, we felt that this gave a stronger and more authentic voice to the survivors. And these are their stories. In a way, I was just the conduit for them.
Right. A last point from this first chapter, and then we'll dig into a few specifics. You write, these stories feel especially germane as we emerge from the fog of a pandemic. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, we went through a kind of, you know, survival crisis of our own as a world, and certainly as a country, as we all kind of were in our little bubbles and cocoons and living in our very separate, quiet lives. Remember the time we were all afraid we were going to get COVID from doorknobs and things? And so the stories, these are stories of survival. And we were all worried about survival on an hourly basis at that time. Thank God for that being less of a pressure for the rest of us now. But so that's part of it. It seemed like, again, perspective. These were survival stories. We were going through a survival story of our own. Medical survival story. I was, you know, battling this abstract enemy called a virus, and you know that you can't see or taste or feel. So this is important to have that. So, yeah, that was part of it. Also, I think again, people tend to get. We were isolated. We were looking inward. These are global stories. These are stories that happened, and are happening, all over our beautiful planet.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Marin. We're talking about her book, I Lived to Tell the World, Stories from Survivors of Holocaust, Genocide, and the Atrocities of War. Elizabeth Marin sat down with different people, actually just more than 13 people. It's 13 stories of survivorship, but in at least a couple of cases, you spoke to a couple of different people who shared that sort of same story. And these are stories of survival that spring from the Holocaust, from horrors in Bosnia, Rwanda, Myanmar, and Cambodia, and so on. And these are carefully crafted accounts of these stories. And it's a beautifully crafted book in so many different ways. You touched on this in the introduction, the fact that all of the people that you talk to in one way or another have a connection with Portland, Oregon. I wonder if you could just say a word about the relationship between the city of Portland, Oregon, and the immigrant community? I mean, to what extent is kind of the collective story of immigrants especially powerful and significant in terms of the kind of community Portland, Oregon is?
You know, it's a good question. I want to repeat, though, that and reiterate that, in fact, yes, they're all here. And I hear this from people here in Portland all the time. They're like, these people are in Portland? There's kind of a sense of incredulity about it. But it could be anywhere, because these communities, these individuals are living among us and leading productive, important lives, and they are contributing to our culture and making us richer in many, many ways. But to step back to your question, so, you know, Oregon has a kind of tattered history around some of these issues. The state was actually founded as a racist utopia, and it was founded as a place where freed black men could not own land. And this wasn't changed until well into the 20th century. So the community of color is statistically not large. It's growing tremendously and growing very quickly, and the Asians are leading the charge on that, which is great. Southeast Asians, big, vibrant Southeast Asian community here. So first of all, this puts the lie to kind of the whiteness of Oregon and the overpowering whiteness. Not that there's anything wrong with white people. I am one. But it puts the lie to that. It tells us that there's much more diversity within almost any community than many people realize. So that's one, I think, one really important point. Portland is also it's a welcoming community. For example, when you cross the street in Portland, the cars actually stop for you. And the ritual is you as a pedestrian wave to say thank you, and the driver waves to say you're welcome on the way back. I don't think that happens everywhere. It's just something part of the culture here. So I think the community has been very welcoming in large part. I don't want to make huge generalizations. Obviously not everyone. And the city of Portland is almost like a separate island among the state of Oregon. That said, it's a very rural state. I mean, there's only 4 million people in this whole big state. I've been really enjoying going to rural libraries to talk about this book. Places where if you turn left, you're in the middle of a field, you know, and staring at a farm animal. And the nature of curiosity and interest in this topic is so gratifying and so heartening when I'm in these communities. Because, again, it sort of puts the lie to the stereotype of, you know, kind of closed-mindedness and so forth. It's been very, very rewarding to see that. This book hasn't been out very long, but I've been very, very happy and rewarded by this kind of sense of not just acknowledgement of the diversity among our community, but the respect for it and the responsiveness to it.
Mm. You just used the word generalization, and it reminds me of an interesting point you make in the book about how you did not want this book to, in a sense, fall in line with what I think at one point you called the trope of the good immigrant.
Right.
And it's a really interesting point. I mean, that, you know, first of all, one might be deeply offended and should be deeply offended by a careless generalization that, you know, all of these immigrants coming in are all this or that, just fill in the blank.
Right.
And, you know, we've heard that kind of dismissive appraisal of immigrants as a whole. And there's just no room for that in adult conversation. One might have certain concerns related to immigrant policy and so on, but those kind of vast generalizations that demean entire groups of people just are completely out of place. But you're talking about a very different kind of generalization, in some ways kind of an opposite generalization, and I just find it really interesting, and I appreciate the fact that this is of concern to you. Explain this trope of the good immigrant and how, even as you're telling these amazing, heroic stories, that was something you wanted to be careful, in a sense, to avoid.
Well, I think all stereotypes are dangerous, no matter what, because they minimize the individual and they minimize personal accomplishments and throw them into a group. So stereotypes are risky on a good day, which is what I try to avoid. And, you know, stereotypes and tropes. But the good immigrant is so grateful to be in the United States and so lucky to be here, having left behind his terrible, I won't even use the word that somebody has used regarding certain countries, you know, left behind their impossible lifestyle and so forth. And here they are having the perfect life here. That's nonsense. That's a fantasy. It's nonsense. It's shallow. It also demeans the lives of people and their own accomplishments and their experiences. They're not perfect people. They're people who probably run red lights once in a while, too, or maybe don't stop for those pedestrians or whatever it is. But they are. So I didn't want this to feed into that kind of, like, the grateful immigrant who's coming back and you know, coming to this country and being just endlessly grateful and doing nothing but good things. Because, in fact, they're normal people living normal lives. Sankar Raman says the same thing. I mean, he came to this country with nothing and with very, very little English. He used to memorize, as a teaching assistant, he would memorize his lectures so that he wouldn't foul up, you know, screw up his own English when he was delivering them. So, but you don't want to cheapen the accomplishments by putting them into a box called the good immigrant, you know, or the grateful immigrant. That said, there's some very common themes that I think are really important. And one of them is a sense of appreciation. And this is universal among all the people I talk to. A sense of appreciation for qualities and traits in this country that many of us who were fortunate enough to be born here take for granted. You know, we just live on a daily, we have them, and we just assume they're kind of part of the deal here, I think, in many cases. So, for instance, Bahir Bhutti, who is an Iraqi psychiatrist, very, very interesting man, very thoughtful man. And he very, very, he came in Iraqi, an old family in Iraq means like 2,000 years, you know. So they go back a long, long way. His family was part of the government, very involved, very active and active in their community, active in the country, very proud heritage. He didn't want to leave his country. He was a mental health professional in an area where there weren't many mental health professionals. He felt committed to his country, but he was always at odds with the regimes. And finally, first his daughter's school bus was bombed. She was badly injured. She was 7 years old. His wife, an obstetrician, was walking toward her car to go home when the car was blown up. Even then, she was not injured, fortunately, but even then he didn't want to leave because he wanted to stay and try to rebuild his country. And finally, his name was on an assassination list. And it was very clear, as he said, it wasn't a matter of whether I would be killed, it was by whom and when. So ultimately they left, and he practices, he's a counselor here, he can't practice medicine, which is another story, but he is a counselor here in Portland, and again a very compassionate and thoughtful man. And as he said to me, here in the United States you can disagree with your elected officials and you won't be assassinated. Okay, think that one through. I mean, as a journalist, I have spared off against senators and, you know, many other elected officials, and no one's ever threatened me. But in his country, it was real. That was the question. If he disagreed with his officials, he was dead. So that's something, again, I don't want to say that's the grateful immigrant. That's someone who recognizes something and appreciates it and honors it. And feels this is a, you know, something not to be taken for granted.
Right, and you know what's so interesting?
Yeah,
I was just going to say, what's so interesting about that is that, you know, you think about some of the people who, you know, like those terribly disturbing incidents that you mentioned early on in the interview, perpetrated by somebody who, in a sense, thinks of themselves as a true blue American. I mean, in their kind of, in their own ignorance. And yet it's so important for us to realize that Often it is someone who comes from the outside, who has sometimes the clearest appreciation of all of what this country really means, as opposed to those of us born and raised here who can so easily come to take certain things for granted. You yourself write at one point, most Americans traditionally have viewed their freedom as an assumption. The subjects of this book know better than to take any right or privilege for granted.
Yes, Eva Egner told me that when she and Les steamed into the New York Harbor on a boat coming from, they were able to come to this country because in 1956, a righteous man, as she called him, President Eisenhower, created an executive action which allowed 100,000 Hungarians to come into the United States as the country was falling to communism. And as she said, the boat nearly sank because everyone rushed to one side to look at the Statue of Liberty.
Hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
I want to...
I've seen the Statue of Liberty. It gives me chills. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. But it's not quite the same as recognizing the extraordinary notion that this group of people sat down and created the Bill of Rights.
Right. Since you kind of started us on this facet of your book, I want to talk about some of the other qualities that you saw again and again in many of these stories. And one of them that was a very commonly shared trait was an absence of self-pity. And you write in explaining that feeling sorry for themselves was a luxury they could not afford. It's so interesting to think about self-pity being a luxury. But of course, in a lot of ways, it really is. And again, it was a luxury in a sense out of the question for at least most of the immigrants that you spoke about who had endured such pain and deprivation in their lives.
Yes, well, if you are, I'm thinking of so many of these examples. And for example, Sveng Ong, who is another Cambodian survivor, I spent a lot of time with. She and I spent 8 hours together one Mother's Day. It was just among other times, and she's a remarkable person as well. And her escape from Cambodia is a stunning story and a stunning story of persistence and determination, and of course resilience. But there were moments when, you know, most of us, okay, you have a broken fingernail. Oh, my God, my fingernail's broken or something terrible. But, you know, she just never had time for that, nor did anyone else. It wasn't going to serve them any purpose. If you took time to feel sorry for yourself, you're wasting time that you could otherwise use to survive and to maybe get yourself out of this situation or at least to make whatever best you could make of it. She's just stunning that way. Just it was not going to do you any good. And the absence of self-pity, absence of bitterness. No one can listen, they all recognize that they came from horrible, terrible regimes and situations. I mean, the regime of Pol Pot, just such brutality, eliminating schools, eliminating private property, eliminating religion. He targeted monks and temples, among others, eliminating intellectuals, people with glasses who were, you know, summarily executed because they might have been smart, they might have been well-educated. This, by the way, from a man who had a degree from the Sorbonne in Paris. Okay, so these were very terrible, horrible people creating awful regimes, and yet to take time to feel sorry for yourself was going to distract from the important task of survival.
Hmm. Something else that you mention in talking about kind of the commonly held qualities of these survivors, and of course, in many cases, we're talking about people who so easily could have been killed. And one of those qualities was a certain kind of fearlessness, a willingness to take bold risks. And at one point, in terms of trying to explain this quality, you write, when death is the certain alternative, what is there to fear? And I really appreciate the way you kind of frame that, because in a sense, that helps to humanize these people. It's not that they are superhuman, that somehow they emerged from the womb with this quality of fearlessness with which they met these terrible challenges. But in a sense, this quality of fearlessness was drawn from them because of the astonishingly awful circumstances in which they found themselves. I'd never stopped to think about the way in which fearlessness itself could spring out of a situation like that.
Yes, exactly. It's a situational trait, I think. I mean, I think maybe there probably are some people who are just born like that, and there probably are. But in this case, these are situations where it just exactly what I, you know, exactly the same thing, that if you're either going to fall off the cliff or get pushed off the cliff or get shot on the edge of the Danube, which was going to happen to Eva and her sister, then what else is there to worry about? You know, you might as well take a risk.
Hmm. And that sense of risk, as you write later in this chapter, risk becomes the inevitable part of the journey to safety. I mean, that part of, although in some ways one must be incredibly cautious as you're knocking on someone's door seeking assistance. On the other hand, if one is not willing to undertake risk, then it is almost certain that you will not emerge alive from what is pursuing
right.
you.
So, Greg, the example that springs to mind when you use that analogy is Emmanuel Tourtouranier, who is a Rwandan genocide survivor, and his father was an Anglican pastor. Hutus and Tutsis worshipped alongside one another in his village. They all played soccer together in the street, barefoot. Emmanuel said he didn't know the difference between a Hutu and a Tutsi until he was about 7 years old. And the teacher told Hutus to stand up, so he stood. And the teacher came over and smacked him because he was a Tutsi, which he didn't know. So, and when the killing started, and these were, you know, killings that were predicted, but not necessarily known in a rural small village where he and his family lived. It happened to be his day. He was 16 years old. It happened to be his day to cook for his large extended family. He was out in the backyard grilling for the family, and his little sister, his young sister Amina, was with him. She adored him and kind of worshipped him. And when the killing started, he scooped her into his arms and just ran like a madman, not knowing where he was going. And eventually, after some false starts that nearly got them killed, he had no other alternative but to knock on the door of a woman he knew, a woman who had worshipped with his father, and ask for shelter. And she was a Hutu. And he knew that in asking her, she might just, right there on the spot, slaughter them both, which was happening. And instead, she said, please come in. Let me shelter you. And she did. And her son was a member of the Hutu militia. And when he came home and found these two Tutsis, their neighbors, there, he was furious. She said, if you will lay one hand on them, I will kill you and I will kill myself. And he then, when the Hutu militia would come to the door and say, anybody there? Emmanuel and his sister were hiding under the bed. And they said, oh, no, there's no one here. That was an example of taking a risk. He knew that this could kill them both, and instead it saved them both.
Right.
Amina just had her first child.
Mm. And
Greg, I want to just mention too, can I just tell you one thing just sort of on a sideline here too? You know, I noticed that you're the minister of music in your church. Emmanuel is a composer and he and a singer, and he makes the most extraordinarily beautiful Christian music. It's just wonderful.
Huh.
You might think about having him as a Zoom guest or a real guest. He's a remarkable guy. Just such a thoughtful man. So, yeah.
I love that story, his story. And of course, I also love the story in a sense of this woman who took Emmanuel and his sister
yep.
in.
Yeah.
That is
yep.
a remarkable part of that story as well. To finish out.
But it mm-hmm. also talks to you a little bit about the humanity that in spite of the evils, in spite of, you know, this extraordinary evil that was occurring in this very little country, 20 Rwandas would fit inside one Oregon. I mean, in this tiny little country, just where, you know, no one kept in count, but close to 1 million people were slaughtered. I mean, in the face of that, there was one person who was willing to say, please come inside.
Incredible. We finish out in our last couple of minutes by talking about this notion of paying it forward, in all of these survivors in one way or another are demonstrating this. And you say at one point in this particular moment, gratitude comes in many packages, many shapes and sizes, but that gratitude plays out in all kinds of different ways. I know that you could probably touch on any or all of these stories. I hope in particular you'll talk about the couple from Hungary with whom the book begins. One or two examples of this way in which gratitude has been lived out in the lives of these survivors in such radiant fashion.
You know, Eva and Les Egner are I'm so sorry to say we've lost Les since the book was written. He was an incredible man. Again, I feel so fortunate to have these stories in my own soul now and in my own life, because I've been lucky enough to sit with people. I often go out and have coffee with Eva. It's costly for me because she's a baker, and oh my God, I eat these, you know, she makes these just beautiful pastries and things. But how have they paid it forward? Well, they came to this country with nothing. They had $25 that was given to them in Camp Kilmer in New Jersey. That got them across the country to some strange and distant place called Portland, Oregon in the 1950s. They had come from Budapest, where there were, you know, I don't know how many opera companies and how many symphonies and street musicians and artists, and they come to this, let's face it, sort of backwater river community in the 1950s, and they could not have been happier. And they created wonderful lives. Eva talked her way into a beauty academy. She wanted to be a cosmetologist. She did this by agreeing to wash the sinks out and paint and, you know, basically become the maintenance woman. Les painted all the walls and did everything for them. Les went on and became a tool and die maker. They had two kids. They educated their kids here. They went to public school. The kids went to the University of Oregon. They vote always. They took part in community events and community activities. And then they decided they really never, ever talked about their experiences. In fact, a lot of people who knew them didn't know they had been Holocaust survivors. It wasn't they wanted to bury it. It was just they were moving on with their lives. But then they decided they wanted, first of all, the Holocaust deniers showed up, and they didn't want to, like, as Les said to me, 6 million people, 9 million if you count the extent of all the killings, said, you know, how can you deny that this happened? It's one of the most well-documented events in history. But people do deny it, so they began to speak out. And they were very instrumental in the creation here in Portland of a really beautiful Holocaust memorial inside Washington Park, which is a big, big park in the middle of the city. It's the home of the International Rose Test Garden. It's really quite exquisite. And it's a very, very moving exhibit and sculpture area there. So they were very involved in that. They also decided they wanted to give back by going into schools and talking about these experiences. And they've been very active in them. Another really good example there's so many, but another good example of paying it forward is Diana Ihas, who is came from Bosnia. And Diana is a musician. Her mother was a furniture worker. And under the somewhat comparatively enlightened communist regime of Governor Tito, she was able to take music lessons starting when she was about six after school. And this is partly so her mother could work in the factory. And anyway, she went on and became played with some of the leading orchestras throughout Sarajevo. And Sarajevo was the site of the largest siege of a capital city in the history of modern warfare, 3 years of being cut off by Serbian bombs and so forth. She was a member of the Sarajevo String Quartet, a group of musicians formed from different orchestras in the city who performed in public spaces throughout the 3 years. They performed in bombed out churches, synagogues, libraries, because they believed that music would provide a balm for the city in the face of these terrible events, and as well, bombs were going off and things like that. And ultimately, she and her husband and baby were able to leave and came to the United States. They arrived in Los Angeles speaking very little English. Deanna didn't drive. Imagine living in L.A. and not having a driver's license. Well, eventually she did. Okay, so she went on, got 2 master's degrees and a Ph.D. in music education. She's a professor at Pacific University here in Forest Grove, Oregon, just outside Portland. And she started something called the Pacific Strings Project, Pacific University Strings Project. And she provides stringed music education for disadvantaged youth, thousands and thousands of them. Again, I had coffee with Deanna a couple weeks ago, and she was on her way to Vienna with a group of students.
Mm-hmm.
She's bringing this in. Yes, I mean, imagine bringing this into the lives, because it was something that had changed, transformed her life, and she believes that this is something that will help transform the lives of others. And they have concerts. It's so gratifying to watch this and to see this. There are so many examples like this.
We have certainly only scratched the surface. I wish time permitted for us to explore even more of these stories. And each one, I should say, is told very thoughtfully, very thoroughly, with plenty of historical background and context. And then we read of the specific events that befell the particular people, the particular survivors. And I think you've done a beautiful job of telling these stories so clearly and authentically. The book, again, is I Live to Tell the World, Stories from Survivors of Holocaust, Genocide, and the Atrocities of War, published by Oregon State University Press, the author Elizabeth Marin. Elizabeth Marin, thank you so much for giving the world this truly important book. And thank you for being my morning show guest today. It was great to speak with you.
Oh, Greg, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm having the best time talking to you. Do we have to stop?
I hate to say it, but I hope we'll get to talk again sometime.
Okay, and thank you so much, Greg. I'm really great. And thank you for your really thoughtful questions. I really appreciate it.
And if you would like to learn more about the nonprofit project, The Immigrant Story, which was really the catalyst for this particular book, I would invite you to seek out their beautiful website, which is theimmigrantstory.org. And an unabridged version of today's morning show interview with Elizabeth Marin will be available in the podcast version of today's program. Look for The Morning Show with Greg Berg wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kaylin Palomares makes her monthly visit to the program, and joining her will be 2 representatives of the Hakmatak National Wildlife Refuge in Ringwood, Illinois. And on Friday, a special walkthrough tour of the beautiful new children's library, KPL Kids at the Uptown Lofts in Kenosha. I'll be joined by 3 staff members from this beautiful children's library on Friday's morning show, an interview which will also be available in video format on our Facebook page and website. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Our skies will be sunny today. Our temperatures mild. A high temperature today of 75 degrees. Clear skies overnight with a low of 61 degrees. Partly sunny tomorrow, Thursday, with a high of 81 degrees. Friday, sunny and 76. Very pleasant conditions expected to continue through early next week. You're listening to WGTDHD, Kenosha Racine, Elkhorn in Lake Geneva. WPR News.